From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In November, Barack Obama and Joe Biden will face off against Mitt Romney and somebody. We'll know soon. Does it matter who? Will the man or woman Romney picks help define the presidency he's promising? The American vice presidency has come a long way, from the ribbon-cutting office where ambitions went to die to the place where wars were started, think Cheney, and ended, think Biden. This hour, On Point, the American vice president. You can join the conversation. Will it make a difference to you, to the next 4 years, who Romney picks? A Palin, a Rubio, a Portman, a Pawlenty. Do you like the new, more powerful vice presidency? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Jokes aplenty through the years, a bucket of warm spit and all the rest, characterizing the sort of, uselessness of the vice presidency very often. 2008 miniseries HBO, John Adams, played by Paul Giamatti, suffers here as the first vice president, key figure of the revolution, relegated to the long shadow cast by George Washington.
The role of vice president is the most insignificant office ever devised by the mind of man. I assure you, it is punishment to hear other men talk 5 hours a day and not be at liberty to talk myself. Me, of all people.
The most insignificant office ever devised by the mind of man, it gets worse. In the long-running The West Wing, Vice President John Hoynes, played by Tim Matheson, had a tumultuous relationship with President Jed Bartlet, played by Martin Sheen. Here, Hoynes reflects on the limits of his office, citing history again.
I like what Daniel Webster said when the Whig Party offered him vice president. I do not propose to be buried until I am dead.
Vice presidents, as in buried alive. And then there's the whole issue of the pick. In his first interview since having a heart transplant in March, former vice president Dick Cheney, who left his own stamp on that office, spoke with ABC's Jonathan Carl about the importance of picking the right VP running mate and said that John McCain's pick of Sarah Palin proved to be a mistake.
I think that was one of the problems McCain had. Governor Palin. I've met her. I know her. She's an attractive candidate. But based on her background, she'd only been governor for what, 2 years. I don't think she passed that test. Of being ready to take over. And I think that was a mistake.
So who is ready? And ready for what? We've got waiting in the wings today a top authority on the vice presidency across time. But let's kick it off with Ron Fornay, editor-in-chief of the National Journal. He's been covering vice presidential picks since 1992. Ron, welcome to On Point. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me back.
So take us into this increasingly, I guess, smaller circle that Mitt Romney is reportedly looking at right now. This pick could come any day, I guess. Who's on the short list and why?
Well, you know, to be honest with you, nobody knows who's on the short list outside of his immediate advisors. One big misperception, if you read the mainstream media and even the new media, is that there's some general knowledge of who the short list is. There's some people who we all suspect are on it, mainly because we all keep mentioning the same names.
Right.
And I can go through those really quickly, but I would caution your listeners that it could very well be somebody who's not been mentioned. But the great mentioners point to people like Senator Portman of Ohio, who obviously could help in an important state. Tim Pawlenty, the former governor of Minnesota. Congressman Ryan, he of the proposed big changes to Medicare
budget.
And other entitlements.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but big budget hawk, a real attractive, relatively young candidate from Wisconsin.
42 out of Wisconsin, yep.
Yep. Governor Jindal in Louisiana has been mentioned by quite a few folks. Then you have folks like Governor Christie of New Jersey and Senator Rubio of Florida who've kind of fallen out of the media mentions, but that doesn't mean that they're not being looked at very seriously.
Have all the women fallen off the list?
Well, again, they've fallen off the media's list.
The mentions list, right?
Yeah, the mentions list. You saw a little spike in Condoleezza Rice last week, I think it was, and that was simply because a prominent blogger, Matt Drudge, mentioned her as a candidate, so we all went stampeding that way. You know, it's interesting. I think the last time that we really knew who a candidate's short list was in 2000 when during the Republican convention, the Democrats conveniently leaked Al Gore's shortlist so as to overtake the narrative at the Republican convention for one day. But generally, we don't know what it is. We pretend we do. In this case, we don't.
What – I mean, you've seen a lot of these picks made. You've watched campaigns go through the process of calculating, sometimes agonizing over who it ought to be. Given the state of the race at this moment, given Mitt Romney's, I don't know, personality, predilections, what do you imagine they're contemplating as key factors in their decision, even if we don't know who it might be?
A lot of factors. There's probably two general ones. One is the traditional one is, can this person help me win a key state? Could a Portman help me in Ohio? Could Ryan help me in Wisconsin? The trouble with that one is recent history goes against that being a main consideration. There hasn't been a vice presidential candidate who has measurably helped win a state, his home state, since LBJ helped win his machine won Texas. Some would say stole Texas in the Kennedy election. The other one is someone who kind of helps enhance your brand or round out your reputation. For example, Al Gore really helped Bill Clinton with the new generation, new Democrat mantra when he became the candidate. That was that was already Clinton's shtick, and Al Gore and Tipper Gore helped underscore it. It's possible if you take that logic a step further, could Mitt Romney be looking for someone who would help underscore his reputation as someone with experience with the economy, with the budget? Maybe there's a businessman out there, an independent-minded businessman who hasn't shown up on the public list that Romney's looking at. Maybe that kind of thinking would help a Paul Ryan. So it's generally one of those two things, someone who I think can help me in a state or someone who can help push the political narrative that I want to have through the convention and through the election.
After the John McCain pick with Sarah Palin, which turned out to be very volatile for him and in the end quite difficult, do you imagine a more cautious pick this time? Or the polls are still pretty close here. You know, do you picture a Hail Mary possibility, somebody with a lot of flash?
If I had a guess, and it would just be a guess, that if you look at Romney, he tends to be a relatively conservative guy, not just politically, but if you look at the decisions he made as a governor in Massachusetts and as a businessman at Bain, and the fact that it is a close election, he's not in a position where he has to throw a Hail Mary. My guess it's a pick where people will say, you know, that makes sense, and that it won't come out of left field. But I would have thought the same for McCain. I was surprised that John McCain threw the deep pass he took and took. You know, it was an incredibly risky decision he did to take Palin, someone who hadn't been vetted yet, who they really didn't know her background. They didn't know how she would stand up beneath the spotlight. And as Dick Cheney said, she wasn't prepared to be president.
Whoever gets picked gets thrown into the middle of it in a great big hurry, and that has produced some quite memorable moments. Here's a little bit from a vice presidential debate. We all recall, but this is Democratic Senator, running mate to Michael Dukakis, Lloyd Benson, delivering one of the great zingers of all time. Not that it got him or Dukakis elected. Moderators pressed Dan Quayle, running mate to George H.W. Bush, on what he would do if the president became incapacitated. Quayle answered. Benson shot back.
I will be prepared to deal with the people in the Bush administration if that unfortunate event would ever occur.
Senator Benson.
Senator. I served with Jack Kennedy. I knew Jack Kennedy. Jack Kennedy was a friend of mine. Senator, you're no Jack Kennedy.
You're no Jack Kennedy. All right. Nevertheless, he was vice president. Ron, stand by. Joel Goldstein joins us right now from St. Louis. He's one of the country's top experts on the vice presidency. Professor of law at St. Louis University School of Law, author of The Modern American Vice Presidency, The Transformation of a Political Institution. Joel Goldstein, thanks for joining us from St. Louis today.
Thanks for having me.
What's the transformation of the vice presidency you're talking about?
Well, I mean, for most of our history, the vice presidency was something of a joke. It was the office that John Adams described in the clip that you played earlier. And yet, in modern times, particularly since the vice presidency of Walter Mondale, the office has grown to be a really substantial contributing part of the executive branch. The growth started in the 20th century, and it picked up with the Nixon vice presidency in 1953. But the Mondale vice presidency really moved the office into the White House, made the vice president a principal advisor and a troubleshooter for the president. And the vice president since Mondale have in varying degrees preserved that role.
So we still have this kind of historical impulse to make the office itself the butt of jokes. Are you saying that's a misapprehension of what it is now?
I think it really is, Tom. I mean, when you look at the sort of things that recent vice presidents have done since Mondale, if you particularly think about what Gore did, what Cheney did, what Biden's doing, they took on highly substantive roles. They were principal advisors to the president. They took on troubleshooting roles. A number of them took responsibility for important governmental programs. It really has become not simply the person who's a heartbeat away, but a consequential part of the executive branch on an ongoing basis.
Why has it grown? Why has the significance grown? Presidents, pretty much relegated them to the observatory home there for a year, for a century and more.
Well, for a number of reasons. I mean, part of it, I think, really traces to the New Deal with the growth of the presidency, the growth of the national government, the decline of parties. But then the Mondale vice presidency really made a huge difference in coming up with a new model for the office.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about vice presidents in a presidential campaign year as we wait for Mitt Romney's VP pick. It said, who knows, it said it could come any day now. It has to come pretty soon. The campaign is moving on. Joel Goldstein is with us, one of the country's top experts on the vice presidency from the St. Louis University School of Law. Ron Fournier is with us from Washington, editor-in-chief of the National Journal. Lots of jokes. Lots of wisecracks. It's an American tradition. Tom Lehrer's political satire, Remember to This Day, one of the songs off his hit album, That Was the Year That was called Whatever Became of Hubert, Democratic Party Majority Whip and all-round powerhouse liberal line, until he became Lyndon Johnson's vice president.
Whatever became of you, Hubert? We miss you, so tell us, please. Are you sad? Are you cross? Are you gathering moss while you wait for the boss to sneeze? Does Lyndon, recalling when he was VP, say, I'll do unto you like they did unto me? Do you dream about staging a coup? Hubert, what happened to you?
Tom Lehrer with the burial in office of Hubert Humphrey, the old campaign humor theme there. Of course, it can happen before you're even in office. Sarah Palin had a rough ride in 08 as she's tried to stake out her creds as the number two leader of the free world, as she put it. Here she is explaining to CBS's Katie Couric, September 08, about 5 weeks from Election Day, her foreign policy experience.
Our next door neighbors are foreign countries. They're in the state that I am the executive of. And
have you ever been
in
Russia. Involved with any negotiations, for example, with the Russians?
We have trade missions back and forth. We do. It's very important when you consider even national security issues with Russia, as Putin rears his head and comes into the airspace of the United States of America, where do they go? It's Alaska. It's just right over the border.
Whoa, even Dick Cheney now says maybe not quite ready for prime time, but even when they make it, the humor goes on. Even in fiction, HBO series Veep, here's Julia Louis-Dreyfus. Louis-Dreyfus as Vice President Selina Meyer.
Hey, Sue, did the president call? No, no.
That's that. Did he call? No, no, he never calls. He never writes. He never calls. But Joel Goldstein, you remind us that the vice presidency in the lifetimes of many Americans today, moved from Capitol Hill right into the White House.
Well, that's right. I mean, it used to be that what the vice president actually did was preside over the Senate. That's where they spent their time. Beginning with the Nixon administration, primarily, they started taking on some executive roles, but they were primarily minor roles. Mondale was the first vice president to have an office in the White House on an ongoing basis, to have access to the president, to get the paper that he got. And the vice presidents since then have retained those same prerogatives and really, to a great extent, the same role that Mondale and Carter institutionalized of advisor and troubleshooter.
And we'll talk about prerogatives, but it's more than that at this point. It is powers. We'll look at those as well as Mitt Romney prepares to make his pick Joel, Ron, stand by. Callers here, Allie in Johns Island, South Carolina. Hi, Allie, you're on the air. What are you waiting for, hoping for?
Hello there, Tom.
Hi.
I'm thinking that he's going to go ahead with a Condoleezza Rice because she's a woman. She's African American, mm-hmm. and it's like a total political move. She has a lot of intelligence. He doesn't speak very well in public. I don't know how much a vice president will be doing, but she is a very eloquent, and I'm an Obama supporter, but I'm thinking that he'll click on somebody like that. He'll try to get the female vote, the African-American vote, and whatever he can. And Condoleezza Rice, I think she's doing other things right now.
Yeah, she might be busy, but who knows? If you're asked, if you're tapped, might be hard to resist. Let us pick it up and bat it around. That's what the Romney camp has been doing, no doubt. I mean, Ron, pick it up just as a name first. How did it rise? Has she absolutely said no? And could you picture it?
Oh, I can picture it. And even if she has absolutely said no, you don't quite believe that because folks have been talked into this job before. The caller, Ellie, is exactly right that it makes a lot of sense politically. Romney's having trouble with the female vote. It's one of Obama's strongest constituencies that if Romney can just shave at it, would really help him in November, and the same obviously with the African American vote. The trouble politically is that she happens to be pro-choice, that she's much softer on the abortion issue than the base that Romney already has trouble with. So it would create a lot of excitement, a lot of buzz. It would probably get really good press attention. It would really focus a lot of attention on Romney and probably make him look more open-minded to the independent voters. But it would cause him trouble on the right. And the question is whether or not Romney's willing to withstand what could be a firestorm even at the convention.
Joel Goldstein, talk to us about the great tradition of saying no to the notion of being vice president. What has it meant over time? People say, no, I'm not up for it. I'm not under consideration. I wouldn't consider it. Do they mean it? What have they meant historically?
Well, it varies. I mean, at this late stage, it's very unlikely that somebody will be asked and say no, because the people who are going to be asked are people who've been vetted. And once you start going through the vetting process, you're pretty much all in.
But what about the no that comes during the speculation period?
Well, again, it's a mix. There are some people who really don't want to do it and who really mean the no. I mean, Mitch Daniels, I think, was one of those this time. There are other people who want to play hard to get. I mean, you don't want to be seen as being too eager and then not be one of those who are considered. That doesn't play very well back at home, that you're trying to get out of whatever position you've got, and then you're rejected by the nominee. So in the earlier stage, it's a little bit of a dance. People play hard to get. At this point, I think that he's unlikely to ask somebody who hasn't been carefully vetted, and somebody who's been vetted is going to say yes.
What's your take on the gender and ethnicity factors here? Is it clear to you? I mean, you know, you've got a very long line of solid white men in this position. But there was the Sarah Palin pick. There was the Geraldine Ferraro pick. Does it look to you like something that would swing a bunch of votes in a gender camp or an ethnic camp?
Well, I think as Ron pointed out, I mean, one of the areas where Governor Romney is weak is the gender demographic and also with national security. What's tricky is that you've got to have a plausible candidate in order to make it work. I think you have to pick a running mate who is a plausible president. Secretary Rice would certainly fill that bill. But as Ron points out, the fact that she's pro-choice, I think also pro-affirmative action, that's been a deal breaker for the Republican base in the past. John McCain couldn't consider Tom Ridge or Joe Lieberman for that reason. George H.W. Bush couldn't pick Alan Simpson for that reason. So I think that really seems to be a deal breaker on their side.
Plausibility as president, because as history has shown us again and again, a vice president can move with great speed right into the top job and a lot of responsibility. Washington, Iowa, Susan is calling. Hi, Susan, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. I think that's a great point, and I would love to hear your guests from St. Louis, even though I live in Iowa. I'm a old Missouri girl. Speak about Harry Truman and how he had to step in when Roosevelt died, and he made the decision about dropping the bomb.
That was a big turnaround. What about the transitions that have gone from one to another, often in emergency circumstances, and the responsibilities that fall quickly to the VP who steps up? What about the case of Harry Truman, Joel?
Well, I mean, that's a great example. I mean, Harry Truman was vice president for 82 days, had really very limited contact with President Roosevelt during that time, and was really stunned when President Roosevelt died and he became president, and didn't even know about the Manhattan Project. I mean, after he became president, was sworn in, somebody took him aside and said, "There's something I think you ought to know." Well, nowadays,
not only know about it, but within days have to make a decision about using it.
Exactly. And nowadays, that's inconceivable. I mean, now the vice president is in the loop, and it's inconceivable that something like that would be going on and that the vice president wouldn't be privy to and wouldn't be part of that decision making. But again, that's something that really has developed since the Carter-Mondale administration beginning in 1977.
That is a great marker, Ron, of how much things have changed. I mean, here was the vice president, didn't even know about the country's greatest weapons program. So much had been poured into it. Now, when the vice president is on the National Security Council,
That happened in the late 1940s, but after Truman was during the Truman presidency.
You know, Ron, we've seen these photographs. For example, when the SEALs went in to get Osama bin Laden, there was Biden right there in the room back in Washington. We see the security role having grown a lot, particularly under Dick Cheney. Talk about war making.
Yeah, and you know, part of that was President Obama, when he was senator and being nominated, realized that this was a weak point in his resume, both politically and even personally. And I think he found comfort in bringing aboard a gray beard who could give him advice on a topic that he really wasn't well schooled on. And it's really important, not only as Joel mentioned, with the growth of government, it is made governing harder, and therefore you need a strong partner. But the globe is getting smaller and much more dangerous, and therefore you have to have a partner who, first of all, politically, the public can see as commander in chief, and then you as the one who's got to make the decisions when you get in office, you want a partner who can help you make them.
And the powers granted along those lines have grown. Here was 2007, then Vice President Dick Cheney speaking with CBS's Bob Schieffer on Face the Nation. This was amid the Valerie Plame scandal, revealed that the administration had leaked the identity of a CIA agent in the field. Cheney said this about his powers as vice president.
I have the authority as vice president under an executive order issued by the president to classify and declassify information. And everything I've done is consistent with those authorities.
Vice presidential authority to classify and declassify information. We'll look at powers. We're thinking about potential candidates. Wendy in Springfield, Illinois. Thanks for calling, Wendy. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. What are you thinking?
I'm thinking that I agree with the previous caller, that Condoleezza Rice would be an extremely intelligent choice for Governor Romney. She's bright, articulate, female, African-American. She's a professor at Stanford. Mm-hmm. She has the experience of being a close advisor to a president, and I think that she would be an extremely good choice.
So you're talking about her as a very competent person, smart person, a lot of experience. In those terms, now she's special on the race and gender side, that's for sure. But think about her, I don't know, up against a Bobby Jindal or Marco Rubio or Rob Portman or Tim Pawlenty. How does she strike you in comparison, Wendy?
Well, I think that when you put her up against a Hispanic vice president possibility, then you start, I don't know, it gets to be a little more difficult, because I think that the Hispanic population is very much growing. And
More difficult in political terms, but what about in I don't know, competence terms? Would you be just as happy or more happy to see Condoleezza Rice as commander-in-chief as, I don't know, Tim Pawlenty, Paul Ryan?
Yes. I think that Condoleezza Rice would probably be fantastic as president.
It's funny, we're talking a lot about Condoleezza, even though, I mean, she's not really on the shortest list that the media is bandying about, but nevertheless, there's experience and there's talent. Wendy in Springfield, thanks for that. Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Emily, you're on the air.
Hi. My feeling about it is that he probably would, if he wanted to have kind of a pop to his ticket, pick a Hispanic female who probably is a strong Protestant. I agree with the previous caller that I think Condoleezza Rice would be a very good choice in the sense that she's very bright, she's had the experience, but I think she's a little bit older, and I think she's got an association with George W. Bush that mm-hmm. is negative.
Sorry, Emily, go ahead.
Well, I think that as Romney being a white male Mormon, that having somebody more mainstream Christianity, so nothing is ever raised about his being a Mormon. And I also think the Hispanics are the rising, quote-unquote, minority in the United States. Mm-hmm. I think that would be a smart pick.
Ron Fournier, are we past the time, thanks, Emily, are we past the time, Ron, when two white guys can sit comfortably on that ticket in a country that is so famously diverse?
We should be past a time when we have to assume that it has to be two white guys. I don't think it's impossible that two white men can still win the presidency. But, you know, this is a very quickly going to become a majority-minority nation, very quickly. And one of the big existential threats to the Republican Party is they are running stampeding away from demographic trends. And Romney would be very well served by considering that fact, not just in who he picks for his vice presidential nominee, but how he runs his campaign, what policies he puts forward, and how he runs the country if he does become president.
We'll know soon enough. I mean, Joel, when you look at history, you know, today we think a lot about gender and we think a lot about ethnicity or race. There was a time when that big thought was put toward geography, I guess, and region and balancing region. How do you assess the weight of these different factors in today's political milieu, Joel?
Well, I think you're right. I mean, that geography, region balancing isn't nearly as important as it used to be, and I think that demography will become more important and is becoming more important. You know, when Walter Mondale picked Geraldine Ferraro, there were no Democratic women senators. There was only one Democratic woman governor, and she'd just been elected. So that if you look for a running mate in the traditional feeder positions and you look for a woman or you look for an African-American or a Hispanic, they just weren't there. Now our country is changing at a point where if you look at those sorts of positions, there's lots of really talented women and minorities in those positions. I think on the Republican side, the challenge this time is that many of those people like Senator Ayotte or Senator Rubio, are relatively new to those high positions. And so the question is, it's something of a risk to pick somebody who's only been in the Senate for a couple of years.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about vice presidents in a presidential campaign year with Ron Fournier, editor-in-chief of the National Journal, Joel Goldstein, one of the country's top experts on the vice presidency. Who would you like to see Mitt Romney pick? What do you think of the vice presidency and what it has become? We still have a lot of fun-in that goes on with it. Here's a scene from the HBO comedy again, Veep, with Julia Louis-Dreyfus as Vice President Selina Meyer, trying to make her mark in Washington, pushing a clean jobs initiative, but all down in the details of mandating the use of utensils made of cornstarch in federal buildings, sort of desperately trying to make a mark.
So I got the cornstarch spoon.
Can we maybe tableware for now, Gary, and focus on filibuster reform?
No, but Amy, look at this. This is classic clean job stuff. I mean, if I can get cornstarch utensils in most federal buildings by the fall, well then, the Veep has landed.
That is what we are working on, landing you.
Yeah.
Like a big, beautiful ego.
Cornstarch utensils and the Veep has landed, but in fact, it is no longer as kind of silly as all that. In May of this year, Vice President Biden made headlines and maybe turned national policy by the president in supporting gay marriage, beating his own president to the punch by several days. Here he is in that interview with David Gregory of Meet the Press.
I am Vice President of the United States of America. The president sets the policy. I am absolutely comfortable with the fact that men marrying men, women marrying women, and heterosexual men and women marrying men are entitled to the same exact rights, all the civil liberties. And quite frankly, I don't see much of a distinction beyond that.
There's the vice president, and within days, the president on the record in the same direction. Mark in Louisville, Kentucky. Mark, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Yes, I wanted to point out that the importance of vice presidency in Theodore Roosevelt, someone that my recollection of history is that they put him on the vice presidential ticket with McKinley to get him out of the way politically, and then he becomes such an influential figure, not only at his time, but he continues to, in terms of nature and his preservation of American land for the public use.
Yeah, no kidding. I mean, talk about a VP who became big with McKinley's assassination. Joel Goldstein, remind us of that history.
Mark's exactly right. I mean, Theodore Roosevelt was the governor of New York. William McKinley's first vice president, Garrett Hobart, had died. There was a vacancy. The people around McKinley said, look, we need to get Roosevelt out of New York. Let's make him vice president, get him out of the way. They did. And in September of 1901, President McKinley was assassinated. Theodore Roosevelt became president.
And off he went with a very consequential presidency.
Was the first vice president to become president and then to be reelected to his own term in 1904.
How many vice presidents have become president as a result of the sitting president being incapacitated?
Well, we've had eight who succeeded following the president's death. Gerald Ford, who succeeded after Richard Nixon resigned, and then five either sitting vice presidents or former vice presidents have been elected president directly from that office.
So it matters. And, of course, many more have gone on to become president on their own electoral steam. Let's get a call from New Orleans. Love hearing from New Orleans. Mario's on the air. Hi, Mario.
I'm Puerto Rican. I'm Spanish descent, so I would love to see Marco Rubio as a VP choice. Mm-hmm. Now, my question is, knowing that Mr. Rubio was not born in the United States, if a situation where the president was to be, the bad president had to be sworn in, how would that work out on the Constitution?
Well, I'm not. I think Marco Rubio was actually born to Cuban parents, but in Miami, I believe.
He was. He was born in the United States.
Joel, what about this requirement of birth? Is it any different for the vice president than for the president? And what is it?
The qualifications for the vice president are the same as for the president. The Constitution simply provides that the person has to be a natural-born citizen of the United States.
So Marco Rubio lined right up for that. Ron Fournier, what about the second guessing on Rubio at this point?
Well, it is just that, second guessing. I think Joel made a very good point that his lack of experience, especially after the Palin political fiasco, cuts against him. He also has some missteps in his personal biography and how that was rolled out and explained that make you wonder, how he would stand up to vetting. But other than those two things, he's a very dynamic speaker, a really smart, well-respected young senator, obviously a rising star. And it would not be a shock to see him on the ticket.
And you hear Mario, Hispanic in New Orleans, yearning for that kind of placement. I mean, it's become somehow, Joel, it seems as if we're making it sort of a marker of American arrival. Just to be on a ticket, to have some representative of one's ethnicity or race or gender.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, when Mondale picked Geraldine Ferraro, it was a historic moment. when Al Gore picked Joe Lieberman, the first Jewish candidate to be on a national ticket, it was a big moment. When John Kennedy was elected president, it was a big moment for Roman Catholics and for America, and the same with President Obama's election. One of the things that's interesting, and it gets back to the point that you were making before about geographic ticket balancing, mm-hmm. is that now we don't think exclusively that with respect to how somebody will play in a particular state, but in a number of states. So with Rubio, the focus, of course, is on Florida, but there's important Hispanic blocks of voters in Nevada, Colorado, New Mexico, other states. And so the calculation isn't simply a one-state calculation.
Let's go to Joshua in Melrose, Massachusetts. Josh, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. I guess my comment is, with all this talk about Marco Rubio, with my friends and family that are Hispanic, they really don't see him as connecting with the Spanish mainstream in the United States. He's a Cuban-American, and you might as well be white if you're Cuban-American because you come to this country legally. Once you get here, you're legally. Same with if you're from Puerto Rico. And actually, within Florida, I think you'd find that there's probably bitterness between Central American, Mexican-American, the majority of Hispanic voters in the U.S. against Cuban-Americans. And so I don't see that as a very strong ticket for the Republican Party.
Might as well be white if you're Cuban. I can't speak to how Hispanics feel about that, but you say in your family, Josh, that's the sentiment?
Yeah, my wife is Hispanic, and my nephew is married to a Hispanic and lives in Miami, and there's certainly bitterness within Miami against Cuban Americans.
Still, I can't help wonder. I mean, look back at Barack Obama. Here he was, a gentleman of mixed racial parentage. There was some ambivalence in the African-American community around that at a certain point. But, boy, once he was on the ticket, with all that prominence, Ron, it's hard to believe Hispanics wouldn't roll in to embrace Marco Rubio. But I don't know. Maybe not, Ron.
Yeah, Josh has a point. Polling will show you. Anecdotal interviews will show you. You spend any time in that culture, there is a definite split between the Cuban American community and Latin American community, and it can be pretty visceral. There's also, by the way, a big split, a black on brown split. Latin Americans looking caustically at African Americans and vice versa. So, you know, none of this politics is slam dunk. And Rubio would be an interesting, groundbreaking, exciting pick, but it would come with risk. And Josh points to one of them.
And that pick inevitably moving toward becoming public very soon here. Lots of response online. Matt Mark is saying having a VP is like having an airbag in a car. They're very, very important when you need them. The rest of the time, you rarely even think of them. Well, yes, but we have seen presidencies in which they became quite prominent. Dick Cheney, right there with George Bush. And in his case, saying he had special utility to the president because he had no ambition of becoming president himself. Here he was. This was an 07 Fox News, a special report called Dick Cheney, No Retreat. And correspondent Brett Baer shadowed Cheney in his private sanctuary in Wyoming, then on a mission to the Mideast. And here Cheney was saying his relationship with President Bush worked well because he had no higher ambition.
It's one of the reasons I think the relationship's worked as well as it has, that I don't have another agenda. I'm not worried about how the Iowa voters are going to judge me in January of 08.
He wasn't worried about much of any kind of judgment apart from his own, it sometimes seemed, and he pushed a lot of policy in that administration. Bob in Des Moines, Iowa. Bob, you're on the air.
Yeah, thank you. I just kind of wonder if I suspect that maybe Romney has asked one or two people and they've turned him down. Maybe that's why there's a delay in getting a vice president. And I'm sure the public would never hear about it because it would make Romney look weak. But you don't suppose there have been some people turning him down and he may have to settle for the third, fourth guy that he really liked to have.
Well, let's see. Ron, any whiff of that? Bob, I appreciate your call. Bob, Ron, any whiff of that?
That's a good question by Bob. There hasn't been a whiff of that, but it is possible that during the vetting process that Joel talked about earlier, that they approached some folks to be vetted and they said, no, thank you. And that that's not quite the same as the nominee calling up and saying no. It's very doubtful the campaign would put Romney in that position. Speaking of Cheney, it gets to one issue that I'd be interested in getting Joel's take on, mm-hmm. and that is we talk about the power of the vice presidency. I think all that power, virtually all of it, is delegated by the president. Cheney had the power he had because Bush gave it to him. Same with Mondale, same with Gore. Mm-hmm. I've wondered what Romney – I think a big question that we should be thinking about is what kind of power, if any, would Romney delegate to his vice presidential candidate if he became vice president? And would Romney's vice president be as powerful as the past? I don't think we should assume that that would be the case.
Joel, what's the pattern there? And once powers are given by a particular president, do they remain with subsequent vice presidents?
Ron's absolutely right. Whatever power the vice president has really in the executive branch while the president is able is dependent upon a grant from the president. And to a great extent, Vice President Cheney's influence was a function of President Bush's style of government. President Bush had sort of a chairman of the board view of the presidency, and for much of the administration, Vice President Cheney was sort of a chief operating officer in many ways, and that was part of the source of his power. Ron says it varies with every administration. So the role of Governor Romney's vice president, if he becomes president, would be dependent upon the relationship between them, the ways in which Governor Romney thinks that the vice president can be helpful to him, what his particular leadership style is, what strengths the vice president has. There certainly is some fluidity. I think the continuing pattern, though, is that every vice president, beginning with Mondale, has had access to the president, has been an advisor, has been a troubleshooter to varying degrees, but they've all had some significance. I mean, Dan Quayle had a lot of face time with President Bush every day and saw the president much more than almost anybody else in the country did.
Mm-hmm. You know, but we heard Dick Cheney saying earlier, I have the power to classify and declassify information. If you think about it, that is not a small power. We talked about how vice presidents since the 40s, as you remind us, have had a seat on the National Security Council. Now, with those precedents, have those powers rolled forward? Does Joe Biden also have the power to classify and declassify access to classified information, Joel?
I'm not sure about that particular example, but as a general rule, once the vice president gets a power, it becomes very difficult to take it away. I mean, when Mondale got the White House office and the weekly private lunch with the president, it'd be very difficult for President Reagan not to have granted the same to Vice President Bush. I mean, you can imagine how would you write the press release announcing that the president didn't have time to have lunch with the vice president? There wasn't room for the vice president in the West Wing of the White House anymore. It would be too embarrassing, really, almost to do. So I think that some of these roles have become institutionalized, and they do get continued from one administration to the other.
I mean, lunch is influence, maybe big influence. Classify and declassify, that's material power. There's so much power in the presidency today compared to some times in history. I mean, Michael writes to us on Facebook. He says, I think the president's office should be split in that the office has become too big for one person. Why do you think the power of the vice presidency has grown, Joel? What is it about the presidency or our times or technology, world affairs, you name it? Why has it grown?
There are tremendous demands on the national government, tremendous demands on America, both domestically and internationally. And the presidency is the locus of governmental power. So, you know, there's more countries that want to have a high-level visit. There are more problems to deal with than one person can handle. If you've got somebody who – a person of real ability who you have confidence in, who can take charge of certain aspects or who can give you the advice of a seasoned political figure, it's a wonderful resource. And I think that presidents have seen really through the success initially of the Carter-Mondale vice presidency that the vice presidency isn't a threat to them as Lyndon Johnson perceived it, as Richard Nixon perceived it, but that it can be something that helps them do their job better. And I think that's in part explains the growth of the office.
One last call, Barbara in Montpelier, Vermont. Barbara, you're on the air.
Thanks, Tom. I would like to hear Joel comment on how really the vice presidential candidate pick influences the presidential election. And we know it should, and it has, like with Lyndon Johnson, he apparently made a big difference. But how about historically, how much has it really mattered?
How often? How much, Joel?
Well, it's tricky to measure. The Johnson, I mean, John Kennedy doesn't get elected without Lyndon Johnson on the ticket. In a close election where people are relatively indifferent between the two presidential candidates, I think the vice president choice can make a difference. Oftentimes, it doesn't make a big difference because the presidential candidates do a pretty good job of choosing people who are plausible presidents. If you choose a plausible president as your running mate, the odds are that the person's not going to hurt you and it may not make a big difference. I mean, if Governor Romney were to pick, Herman Cain or Michelle Bachmann or any number of people, it would make a huge difference. He's not going to pick those people. He's, I think, going to pick somebody who's a plausible president, and that tends to minimize the impact. So part of the – but I mean, I think in 1976, for instance, Mondale, I think, played an important role in Carter's election. He spent a lot of time in Ohio, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, states that Carter barely won. And those states were crucial to Carter's victory.
What do you think, Ron? How big a factor in this election is the pick that we're likely to see any time now for Mitt Romney?
I agree with Joel. This is going to be a close election, so it could have a difference, but it's going to be hard to measure and won't be huge.
Well, but it will be, with a Romney victory, would be the person who stands next to the president and next to that office. Of course, it's really interesting history and interesting dynamic right now, the way it represents American ambition, yearning, aspirations for different groups within this country, and maybe the difference between election and defeat. Ron Fournier, editor-in-chief of the National Journal, thank you so much for joining us, Ron.
Thank you.
And Joel Goldstein at the St. Louis University School of Law. Thank you, Joel.
Thanks, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.